All right, the fourth and the fifth chapter of Judges is where we're at, and we're in the fourth chapter actually, but the two chapters are tied together as you study this. They are about Deborah, and we've already talked about the fifth chapter is what's called the Song of Deborah, and it deals not just with Deborah, but you remember that it also deals with, just for a little bit, with Shagmar, and Shamgar, excuse me, Shamgar. All right? Most lists, and I told you this, most lists put down Deborah and Barak as the judges. And I think we talked about this last week, that it really doesn't seem like Barak is a judge. He is a military man, is what he is. And he's actually called into action by Deborah. Who we also discovered, what else we find out about Deborah last week? Not only is she a judge, but what else we find out about her?
She's a prophet.
She's a prophet, okay, or a prophetess. And we talked about a little bit about the different offices in the Old Testament. You have the prophet, you have the priest. Clearly, I mean, it has to be almost without dispute that a woman could serve in the place of a prophet. Deborah was, and God was speaking to her. The restriction on women actually in the Old Testament, if you read this, was that they could not serve as a priest, because they were not allowed to go into a certain parts of the tabernacle. So they were restricted from doing that. But there seems to be no restriction when it comes to this matter of God speaking through them and using them as prophets. Now again, there have been a lot of conjecture as to why God would use Deborah. And I've had people say everything from almost, you know, apparently there weren't any men who were listening to God, so God spoke to the one person who was listening to him. I don't know if that's true or not. That's information not given to us. But what is given to us is that Deborah was a woman that God spoke to and spoke through. And not just on this one occasion, because clearly, as we read last week, people came to her for her judgments and her wisdom all the time. They talked about that she sat under the tree or the palm of Deborah. She had her own tree. You know, it's kind of like, you know, having your own office. And people come in for counseling and stuff like that. So they knew where she was. And men and women alike apparently came to Deborah and said, you know what, we have this concern and we need your help. It would also be, I think, legitimate to say that not only just men and women who were going through things, but sometimes when, remember there were those who sat at the gates of the communities? And they were really the town elders, if you will, and they would listen to disputes, and they would make decisions. Well, when they couldn't, where would they go? And they would go to Deborah. Okay. So it was not that she just sort of popped on the scene. Before we know anything about her, we see that she's already being used of God. God has given her wisdom, and God not only has given her wisdom, but God has given her insight, prophetic insight, because she was believed to be a prophetess by the people. Okay, when you see Barak's response to her, he believes she's a prophet. There seems to be no doubt in his mind that he believes, and so much so that he doesn't want to go do anything without her being there with him. Okay? Any input on that before we go on? Okay. Well, who are some of the other players? We've already talked about Barak. We've talked about Deborah. Who is Jabin? Anybody?
King of the Canaanites.
King of the Canaanites, okay. Located right up here above the Sea of Galilee. What's the name of the community that it talks about right there? Remember? Go ahead. Anybody?
Hazor,
okay. Most of the battle that we're talking about is this area, this region right here. Below the Sea of Galilee, all the way over to the Mediterranean Sea. Those of you who've been to Israel, you know right here is a place called Haifa today. Right here is a mountain called Carmel. Right here is another mountain called Megiddo. Over here you have Mount Tabor, okay, which I don't know how many remember what it looked like, but Mount Tabor really is just like a rounded hill out in the middle of the Jezreel Valley. Okay, this is the area that we're talking about. So you have the king, the Canaanite king, okay, who has who God is using Deborah to prophesy against. You also have a guy by the name of Sisera, who is? Well, yeah, he is a bad guy. All right. Who else is he besides a bad guy? He's a general of whose army? The Canaanite army. Okay? So, you're going to have a conflict with Sisera, okay? And Sisera had at his disposal how many chariots? Remember? 900 chariots, which should tell you not only did he have chariots, but he had a lot of foot soldiers. Okay? But 900 chariots is quite an arsenal. Okay, and you remember the Jezreel Valley? That would be an ideal place if you were going to get in a battle. Okay, and you had the armament of chariots. The Jezreel Valley is perfect. Okay, in other words, if you did not have those chariots, you'd be in trouble. That was what the geography of the area is like. But God has a hand in this too. Remember that. Okay. And by the way, when it talks about how God gives them victory in chapter 4, it doesn't tell how he gave them victory until you read it in Deborah's song. What took place. Now, so, verse 7, let's start there this evening. And it says, the message that's coming from Deborah. And against you I will deploy Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his multitude at the river Kishon, and will deliver him into your hand. So speaking prophetically, she's telling Barak that God has promised that he will deliver into Barak's hand Sisera and the armies of Jabin, or the Canaanite armies. You know, it's a good thing when you know you're going into a game you're going to win. You know, when you know you're going to win it and stuff, when it's a guaranteed thing, it's not. You know, if you think about it, we who are believers, that ought to be our approach to life. You know, it's already set. The enemy has been defeated, and we need to trust. We need to trust our commander, and wherever he leads us, that's what we need to do. And know that when it's all said and done, we have the promise of eternity, don't we? And so we don't have to fear the enemy because of the promise that we've been given by God. So her prophetic word is: if you go, as you go, and you're obedient to God, God will give you victory over the Canaanite army. Okay. Now the question always comes up: when God speaks, when God's word is given. Now, of course, she didn't read it out of a book like we do, but when God's word is given, the question always remains: what will God's people do with God's word? Okay, will they hear and obey? Will they doubt? Will they be completely disobedient? And I think that's a timeless issue that we have when God's word is spoken into our lives or read into our life. What are we going to do with it? You know, you'd think we had learned by now that the best thing we could ever do is just trusting, but that's not always the case. Okay, verse 8 says, "And Barak said to her, 'If you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go.'" So, do you assume that he has some doubt here? Do you assume that he's just trusting in this lady who is a judge and knows maybe from times past the way God worked through the judges, and when the judges were present, that you know that God did mighty things, like we just read about Shamgar and who killed 600 men with an ox goad and stuff. What do you suppose?
I think he had a little bit of lack of faith.
Okay.
He's not willing to go by himself. And so he says to her, "Thank you."
I love this little series of here because it reminds me of something very important. The will is going to be accomplished. Everybody got that? God is going to do what he's going to do. You don't have to worry. No one is going to thwart his plan. Okay? The question isn't, is God's will going to be accomplished? It is when God reveals that will to us and calls us to that will, if we respond yes, and we receive the blessing of what God does. If we doubt or if we reject Him, then we miss that. Does that make sense to you?
But doesn't that happen today? That isn't it part of our nature? Let's say something terrible happens and you call me on the phone and say, Doug, I need you to go over there and take care of this situation. And I say, I'll go if you go with me. Isn't that the same thing?
Yeah.
Sure.
Because I'm relying on the spiritual leader. I'm not relying on God per se. I'm okay if you go, and I'll face anything as long as you go. But if you don't go, I can't go on my own.
So what's the cost of that, though? Well, I mean, if God is actually saying for you, for any of us individually to go, but then we have to bring other people on board. There is a cost. And it's not a cost. I don't think it's a cost to the will of God. I just don't believe that. I just believe it's a cost. If God leads someone to be the person. Okay. How about this? We talked about this even Sunday night when we talked about the most effective way to share the gospel. What if God brought someone into your life and God, you know, established a good relationship between you and that person? And the time comes where that person just opened to the work of the Holy Spirit, and God has appointed for you, who you've made a friend with, to speak His gospel into this person's life, and you get right to that point. You say, "Oh, wait a minute! I got to go get my pastor, or I got to get, you know, someone who knows more than me." And God still saves that person because that's what God does. But I wonder how many times we miss that God saves us in that situation.
My Bible, it says, and I don't read all of it, but Barak's request shows that at heart he trusted human strength more than God's promise. Could it be?
Yeah, and if you think about it, it really is, we don't want to cut it this fine, but if you think about it, it really is the opposite of biblical faith.
Yeah.
Okay? Biblical faith is not by what you, we don't do it by what we see. Okay? Chris.
You know, I can agree with what's being said, but I also think that the Jews are very pragmatic, and it's kind of a quality control step, and it's follow up on them.
Yeah.
You know, do you really mean what you say? Move at all. I mean, after all, there's lots and lots of lives at stake here, and it's not like just one life or it's the whole two armies. And I think it's a good idea myself.
To take.
I do. It's quality control, you know.
Okay. Well, and I agree with that. I think the situation determines what our approach ought to be. I don't think there's two or three people doing anything. I think what we have the issue is, what is God's instruction? And if God's instruction is, you go, you lead, then it is, it becomes an issue of faith if I don't do that. Or if I partially do it. If God says, I'm going to work this out, and He brings all, brings 100 people beside us. You know, that, you know, so I think this matter of faith is the following of God's leadership. And I would go along with Chris, even if God, if it wasn't specific, I think I would do the most pragmatic approach too. You know, so, good points. Alright, so, here's what happens next after he said, if you'll go with me, then I will go. It's set, now verse 9, and here you're going to see the cost for Barak. Okay? He says, so she said, I will surely go with you, never in the taking, for the Lord will call Sisera into the hand of a woman. Then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. So, at least in this instance, it seems pretty clear that he has made a decision, and that decision has consequences. And I think we can say every decision certainly has consequences. But we see here that he is not, I personally don't think that he is clearly following God's direction and trusting God in this instance. Now, I'm not condemning him for that, because I think you and I maybe would do the same thing. Okay? But there is that reality to trust God. The instruction was for him to go, but he didn't go by himself. He had to have Deborah. So she says, I'll go with you, but you need to understand there'll be no glory for you. But God is going to end or sell Sisera. God's still going to defeat Sisera, but he's going to defeat him at the hands of a woman. Now, I was reading in one of the commentaries today, which I thought was pretty interesting. First of all, he said, thinking that Barak didn't really have a whole lot of a problem with this, because he'd already said, I'm putting my trust in Deborah, and his first thought may be that Deborah is saying that he's going to be delivered into Deborah's hand, and he wouldn't have any problem with that because of who Deborah was. You understand what I'm saying? His concept was, you know, when she says he's going to be delivered in the hands of a woman, maybe his idea was, well, okay, you're the judge, you're the spiritual leaders. I don't have any problem with that. That's who you are. But as you read the story, it's not quite how the story ends up. Okay, so certainly his initial response seems pretty benign. He's willing to do this because, again, he's willing to, you know, I would even think that, you know what, it don't matter to him. Deborah is Deborah, and most people will see him as the leader of the army, even though she's there. So I still think he kind of assumes, I'll get what I need to get out of this. Because I think he believes it's Deborah that is being prophesied about here when it comes to this passage. Any input or thoughts on that? Well, sure. Well, yeah.
I mean, when you have a leader, you know, someone like Deborah, and you've seen what she's done, some people don't care if they're, you know, get the.
Well, I would agree with that, but I would say, by experience, that most military commanders don't fall into that category you just talked about. There's something that's made up in the military mindset for victory, for I mean, the whole thing, if you think, the whole setup is set to be recognized, to gain rank, to gain position, all the way up. That's the way I don't think he has a problem with Deborah. I really don't think he has a problem with Deborah. He's trusting Deborah. I agree with you on that. And I really think he thinks Deborah's talking about herself. But there is going to be some shame in this. And Deborah said there would be some shame in this, you know, for him. Okay. By the way, if you think about some of the mindsets, remember what happened when David came back into the city after his military things, and one of the people began chanting or singing. Yeah, Saul killed his 1,000, but David killed his 10,000 and stuff like that. And, you know, and how did Saul feel? Yeah, very jealous. Yeah. All right, verse 10. It says, and Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh. Now, you understand that he did not call Zebulun the son of Jacob and Naphtali the son of... Right? Everybody got that? He's talking about those tribes. And more specifically, I would say he's talking about the military units from those tribes. Okay? So he called them there. He went up with 10,000 men under his command, and Deborah went up with them. They went up to Mount Tabor. Okay? Which is just below and maybe a little bit west of the Sea of Galilee. It's mostly at the eastern end of the Jezreel Valley. The western end of the Jezreel Valley goes right into the Mediterranean Sea. The eastern end sort of goes right into the Jordan River Valley. So that's how far it runs. Today it runs the full breadth of Israel, from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River. Okay. So they go up there, 10,000 of them, which again, 10,000 seems like a lot of people. Except when you start adding up the chariot issue with the foot soldiers that would have went with them. and you know that Sisera was not going to come with less than he needed. Okay, the king would not have sent him that way. So, says verse 11, says, now Heber, Kenite, of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, had separated himself from the Kenites and pitched his tent near the tabernacle tree at Zanaim, which is beside Kadesh. Okay? Now, I don't know if you're Kadesh. Well, I can't even see this thing. I can't see Kadesh. Can anybody see it? It should be in that area. I think it should be in that area of...
Is it right under the name Zebulun?
It's between Dan and Hazor. Right. A little bit over
there. Right there?
Yeah.
Is that Kadesh?
It looks like Kadesh.
Yeah, it does.
Boy, eye problem. Here we go. Yeah, I think it's right there. It again is not too far from Tabor, Mount Tabor, that you see right in this area right here. It's right in this area right here. Okay? Still in the Jezreel Valley. Okay? What are y'all talking about?
Nothing.
Okay. Now we have another personality brought into this. Heber. Okay? He's a Kenite. Didn't we already find that one of the judges that are already appreciated this time was a Kenite? Okay. Related to who? Y'all remember? Anybody remember? Related to?
Caleb.
Okay. We see here that this group was also related to the father-in-law of Moses. Okay. Now, what do you know about the father-in-law of Moses and this group of people? What do you know about their lifestyle? We nomads is one term. We have a different term for them.
Bedouin,
yes. Okay? Bedouins. People of the land. Okay? The Bedouins knew no boundary. Today, the Bedouins know no boundary. They cross Jordan into Israel, and they're the one group that doesn't go through... They don't go through... security or anything, they do what they want to do. It's an incredible phenomenon when you think about how secure Israel is at times. Yet Bedouins just come right across the border, you know, and they live wherever there's grass and water, and they stay there as long as there's grass and water, and then they move on. All right. Now, when you look at this story, there's some things you need to know about Bedouins. Bedouins are ancient people. And they live today like they lived 4,000 years ago. It's an incredible group of people. The Bedouins are set up, and they had their own laws. And one of the things that they hold very dear to them. Anybody ever see Lawrence of Arabia? One of the things that the Bedouins have very dear to them is a matter of water. Okay. They also have a law. They have a law that if a stranger comes into your tent, to your group of tents, actually, you must keep them 3 days. But if he stays after 3 days, then they've killed because of that. It's an incredible thing. You have a guy there 3 days, and after 3 days they're up, he's still, because they consider him to be a thief after 3 days. Okay? And a lot of the issues of the Bedouins, you can see in the movie Lawrence of Arabia. Okay? So, the Bedouins are set up where they are nomadic, as was said. Camels are very important to them. I can tell you what they do with camels, but it might, you know. Remember, you were over there when we went to the Bedouin camp where it talked about that actually the ladies will wash their hair in camel urine. They don't waste anything. You know, so...
Having a bad hair day.
They checked
that camel he was.
But anyway, the other thing that the Bedouins do, the Bedouin men are allowed, according to their culture, to have four wives. Four wives.
Four men.
Huh?
Four men.
Yeah. Okay, I didn't say that. It was a lady who said that. Okay, four wives. But they were required... Because of the culture, too, they had to prove that they could provide for four wives. It wasn't just some guy could go out and marry four women, because if he was going to marry someone's daughter, he would have to provide the dowry and also prove that he could take care of her. And one of the issues that they had to have was each woman had to have her own tent. Now this is what you need to understand. They had their own. They had, and that's why this story. It's in this story. So it starts. You'll notice when we get to when we talk about this lady, it's talking about her tent. Not her husband's tent, her tent. Okay? Yeah. All right, so a Bedouin's tent was made up like this. Okay? And three compartments. It might surprise you what these three compartments are. You had the bed chamber. Now, most of the time, they did anything to do, like cooking everything outside. There was no cooking and stuff inside. Okay? You had the bed chamber, where that was the woman's place. When her husband would spend time with her, that's where he would go, into her bedchamber, because it was her tent. And if he was going to marry a woman, he had to provide for her tent. Okay? You have the more open place where guests were allowed to go in. A guest was not allowed in here. And a guest was not allowed in here. Now, this larger area is actually the animal place. And they told us when we were over there, oh, you think that's bad to have animals indoor. But he said, to the Bedouin, that animal smells better than you do, so don't worry about it, type thing. Okay? So, the Bedouins provide each of their wives, up to four wives, this tent, along with the dowry, in order to marry them. So you could have a Bedouin with four different wives, and when they, and most of Bedouin men do nothing. What a life. They sat around. Almost everyone I see, they sat outside the door of one of these tents. And when there are multiple tents there, you know, and there are children around here, some of the children will sleep wherever the mom tells them to sleep. A lot of times in this area right here, sometimes in with the animals. Okay, but she gives him permission to come in. Okay, it's her tent. Right? But he will sit outside. But when the water is not good, or when all the grass, and there's not a whole lot of grass over there in the Judean desert where most of these are, then it's time to move on. And what he will do, he'll just sit out there, and she'll load up, her and her kids will load up the tent, put it on the camel, and then when everything's done, he'll get up, get on the camel. He usually sits out there and smokes cigarettes and drinks sweet tea. Okay? And then he'll get on his camel to ride to the next thing. He'll get off his camel. She'll get the tent out, do the tent, you know, and he'll sleep in one of the tents, whatever one is. Now, you very rarely get to see a Bedouin wife. She does not come out in public. We had a young lady who was like 16. Who, when we went to a Bedouin camp, she made us what's called ash bread. Okay, and what we saw this time was not a Bedouin camp. I mean, it was a remake of a Bedouin tent and stuff. But little twigs they would break up. I mean, just a little twig, and they would burn them in a, like where a fire pit is and stuff. I'm not talking about like when we talk about a wood fire. Just little, and then they would flatten out this dough and put it right on the ash. And when they give you a piece of it, you brush off the ash and stuff before you eat it. And then they come out with these little glasses, and it looks like 500 people have drank out of that same glass as you drink out of. I was sitting there praying that prayer. If they bring you something to eat, you eat, and you'll be okay, type thing. You know, that what Paul said? If they bring it to you, eat. Be grateful for it. But anyways, that's kind of some of the Bedouin culture. They're fascinating people, okay? And pardon me, go ahead.
The men have no responsibility.
No, well, they're
poor wives. What do you want?
And he's not far off. They are there. The men are there for procreation purposes, and to build the tribe. Okay, and you'll remember for a period of time, even after Moses had married Zephra, did I say that right? Zephira or whatever her name. Okay. He had to stay in Jethro's camp for a while, because his kids, their kids, were Jethro's kids for a while. Same thing when you think about Jacob. Remember, he had to serve Laban for 7 years to marry Rachel. Laban slipped the cow-eyed one at him and stuff, and And then he says, well, I'll work for you 7 more years for your good-looking daughter. That's what, I mean, that's my translation. Could probably get me in trouble after a while, but that's basically what happened. Okay, so that's the kind of culture we're talking about right here. Okay, but the men actually don't and have not really, they don't work the sheep. Then tell their kids the women work whatever sheep there are. The men don't do that. Once the kids come along, the kids, they do that and stuff. And so it is really interesting culture. Now, I tell you all that because when you read this passage here, it tells you that these people here, they're not people that are located permanently in this geographical situation. They're Bedouins. They're traveling through. Now, in order to be a Bedouin, you have to be somewhat diplomatic. Wouldn't you agree? Because look at all the land. Who's in this land? You got the Canaanite. You got all the ites in the land. Plus, you got the Israelites in there also. Okay, so you got to be pretty good at being friends with pretty much everybody. Okay, and that actually is the case right here. It's not that this man and his family were pro Canaanite. It's just that they had pretty much made an agreement with the Canaanites that they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't fight them, or they wouldn't. Not only would they not fight them, but they would not fight, or they would not help their enemy. Okay, and was it Bedouins have this little saying in some of the Middle Eastern thing about the friend or the enemy of my enemy is my friend type thing. And that's an ancient way of looking at things. That's what they're talking about right here. Okay, any questions on that? Any input? All right, let's go on in verse 12. It says, and they reported to Sisera that Barak the son of Abinoam had gone up to Mount Tabor. So Sisera gathered together all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the people who were with him from Harosheth, Hagoyim, to the river Kishon. Okay, so we've already talked about this. You probably won't find that place that described there as a city on any of your maps. The last part of that word Hagoyim speaks of the nations. Okay, so clearly what he's saying is that he had not only a Canaanite group with him, but he had people from many different nations that were joining him in this battle. Okay? Verse 14. And Deborah said to Barak, up, for this is the day in which the Lord has delivered Sisera into your hand. Has not the Lord gone out before you? So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. So all we have here is a proclamation that it's the day. Something else has happened here that is not recorded for us in this chapter. What do you think that something else is? How did Deborah know it was a day? Well, some people say, well, just that God told her. And that could be. But something else has happened here. Anybody? Anybody watch the news about Australia? What's going on down there? There's a flood that takes place here. The rains have come. The flood has happened. And what God has done, the hand of God has brought these 900 chariots into the hand of the commander of his army. Basically, as you read the Song of Deborah and you remember the stories that come out of this, is that God made the 900 chariots ineffective. They were bogged down in the mud. That's the picture. And God gave them into Barak's hand. Okay? And you'll see that, let's see, over in chapter 5, what are the verses right there we talks about there? Verse 19, and the kings came out and fought. The kings of Canaan fought in Tanakh by the waters of Megiddo. Okay? And took no spoils of silver. They fought from the heavens. The stars of their courses fought against Sisera. The picture there again speaks of something above. And some people say, well, that was the angels that fought against Sisera. Or could it not have been the description of this great storm that made them ineffective? All of us would say, whether it's angels or it's a storm, it's the hand of God there. I think we agree. But then it tells us in verse 21, the torrent of Kishon swept them away, the ancient torrent, the torrent of Kishon. O my soul, march on in strength. So he talks about, or Deborah, it's recorded here through the Song of Deborah, of how God used the rains and the floods and these things to defeat this mighty army. Okay. Anybody? All right, let's read on, because we'll just keep reading on what took place. It says verse 15, and the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled on foot. Good question. Why would he do this? You know, is it not faster being a chariot pulled by horses than running? Of course it is. Unless your chariot is bogged down in the mud and you can't get it moving. That's when you jump out. It's like when your car dies, you can sit there and say, well, this isn't getting me anywhere, or you can get out. Okay? So he gets out of his chariot and he takes away on foot. It says, but Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as, that, there's that name again, which refers to the nations or the city of the nation. And all the armies of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. Okay? Does that mean that they completely annihilated them? Well, some say yes, and some say anybody that stayed around, anybody that they pursued, they killed. But clearly, not everybody was dead because Sisera was not dead yet. So basically, whoever they pursued, they killed them. They defeated them. That's the terminology that is used there. Okay? Verse 17 says, however, Sisera had fled away on foot to the tent of Jael. Or Jael, which is an interesting combination of names, Jael. Okay, both of them have to do with deity, Yah, and El, God. Okay, so he fled to this thing, and the wife of Jael is the wife of Heber the Kenite, which we just talked about, one of the better ones. For there was peace between Jabin of Hazor and the house of Heber, or Heber, the Kenite. So they had an alliance. Or at least they had an agreement. Okay. So it says, and Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me, do not fear. And when he had turned aside to her into the tent, she covered him with a blanket. Okay, this was not, I mean, just bottom line, these Bedouin women would not let another man come into their tent. They would not. Okay? And so there's a lot of conjecture that goes on here. Was she trying to entice him? Well, we know she had something in her mind. Clearly she had something in her mind. But did she make him feel this way that he could do this, and that there was something that would result in this? I mean, it's not the normal thing that you see here. You would not have a strange man in your tent in this way, especially if your husband was not there. Comments? Give me the look.
Yeah, I don't understand it.
I don't understand it fully either. But he clearly thinks it's okay for him to do this. Now, he's a man of great stature. And, you know.
Look what she says to him. Do not be afraid. I mean, that's unusual. Okay, I guess he's pretty messed up and he's on the run and his army's been defeated and everything. And I guess this area and the Bedouins there were aware of the battle that went on. But she's offering him comfort now.
Right.
There's something really sinister here.
Well, and what does it mean? What does it mean to say? And I don't understand this in our life. Turn aside to me, and then she said, "Don't be afraid. It's okay for you to do this." I mean, that's the question. Is it? Don't be afraid that someone's going to get you. I'll protect you. Or come into me. Don't be afraid. It'll be okay. Don't fear. I mean, that's a question. At least we need to consider, because she is another man's wife, and she is inviting him into her tent. And go ahead.
Did this imply that she knows him? Because you said that they don't meet in public.
Well, that would be a good. I don't know. I don't know if she would even know him. She might know of him, and know of. Clearly, her husband would have had to speak to him because remember, this was a commander of the Canaanite king's army for that whole region. That's who we're talking about right here.
Sisera.
Sisera is. He. That's why the Canaanite king sent him. This is the region that he served in. He knew this region and stuff. So I don't know if she would know him personally, but even if it would almost seem even more sinister or even more worse if she did know him personally.
Don't you think, Bill, that being a typical woman, that when he met with her husband, speaking out death, she knew who he was?
Could have been.
She went outside,
which was a proper thing to do if she was going to speak to somebody. But then she did the improper thing by inviting him into her tent.
Yeah, that's got to be, well...
I think she had purpose.
Oh, there's no doubt. We'll see the purpose is going to happen in a minute. Yeah.
You know, Sisera, number one, he's not a Canaanite. Sisera is not a Canaanite name.
No, it's not. I don't.
It could be Egyptian. He could be an Egyptian. He could have started as a mercenary for Jabin and then went on.
Right.
I think,
mm-hmm.
Whether that means anything here or not, I don't know. It could be, though, that maybe Sisera did some things to these Kenites, these Bedouins, every once in a while. I mean, he had the power to do whatever he wanted.
Yeah, we don't have the background. You're right. And remember what I just said. He and his armies ruled that whole area. So I'm certainly they had experiences with them. Good, bad, and all other kinds. Interesting. Anybody else? Any thoughts?
I think she's telling him, "Don't be afraid to put him off guard."
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. You know.
But if he's in her tent, he probably feels pretty secure because he knows nobody else is in the room.
Right. We have to see this as an offer of intimacy, and I'm not talking about sexual things. It could be, but I'm not saying that's why. It's an offer of intimacy that's outside the norm. That's what I'm saying. Which, by the way, if a woman were to do that in a day, it would make you probably feel more secure. I mean, her reputation is that, you know, she's going to let me come into her thing. She's not going to talk about this. So I can rest in here. So I don't know. All those things come into play.
He's going to ask her to do something too, though. That let's go on. This is too cool.
Okay. Verse 19. Then, end of verse 18. And when he had turned aside with her into the tent, she covered him with a blanket or a rug. Some translations say rug. Some say blanket. I don't know if there's that much of a distinction in this day. Okay. Verse 19, then he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened a drug of milk. And you know why I'm saying that? Because I think she's drugging him. I do. You know, she opened a jug of milk and gave him a drink and covered him.
Does yours really say jug of milk?
Mine says jug of milk. What's yours say?
A skin
of milk?
A jug of milk. I thought you were just making it up.
No, mine actually said.
Yeah, you took a little paper.
But, anyways, there's a difference between drinking milk when you're exhausted and drinking water. And I think she knew that. And I don't even know that we know the amount of time that, you know, between the time he gets this milk and what happens, what it is. Okay. Any other thoughts on the milk? All right. And he said to her, "Stand at the door of the tent, and if any man comes and inquires of you and says, 'Is there a man here?' you shall say, 'No.'"
See, that goes about what you were talking about.
Yeah.
That the woman, no one could go into the woman's tent.
Yep.
So even if the husband came, and I don't know whether he's implying that.
No, that's good. That's any man is what he says.
Yeah.
And you tell him there's no man in your tent. Okay. All right, then verse 21. Then Jael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg. Now, this is, between that last statement and then, you have to know it didn't happen just like boom, boom. Okay? There's a time in between this that's not given to us. Everybody got that? That's why I think that she offered the milk so he would sleep more soundly. I said it was drugged. I don't know about drugs or anything. Could have had, who knows? It could have had herbs and stuff like that in there. Could have had what?
Camel urine.
I don't know what puts a guy out. All right, so. And he was exhausted from the run and from the fight. He's been in a battle, and he's been running, and now she's going to give him, you know, something that would be a sedative. If it's a natural sedative, that's fine, but it's still a sedative. The milk itself. Okay, so. After a period of time, clearly he's gone in, he's out. He's crashed big time. Okay? And here's what happens. It says, then she took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand. This is a woman right here. Now here's the part you need to understand. I can see some of our ladies say, oh, I could never take that big hammer. That, and remember, we're talking about a mallet. Okay, and we're talking about a peg that holds up, that helps hold up a three-chamber, heavy, made out of sheep hair, goat hair, woven tent. Okay, and some ladies tell me, I couldn't have done that. I just couldn't have, you know. And how did she know how to hit that? The reason she knew how to hit that thing because she did it all the time.
Went through his head and into the dirt.
Yeah. She knew what to do with the big mallet, and she knew what to do with the tent peg. That's what you need to understand. Because she did it all the time. She pounded it into that Middle Eastern ground all the time. Because again, it wasn't her husband that tore down and set up her tent. She did it.
Plus he wouldn't have done it anyway.
Why's that?
Because he's a guy, he's a man. He didn't have
smoking
a cigarette. Right,
had nothing. Yeah, you can't get anyone with manual labor.
Yeah.
How did it ever get to be called manual labor if it's a woman doing it?
Yeah.
All right. So we read on. Here's what it says. She took the tent peg and took a hammer in her hand and went softly into him and drove the tent peg into his temple. He's asleep, right there. Okay? She knows where to put the tent peg too, doesn't she? And into the temple, and it went down into the ground, for he was fast asleep and weary, so he died. I like how they say it. So he died.
But he wasn't getting up anyway.
Well, even if he wakes up, it's, you know, anyway, I don't want to get too graphic on this, but he did. I didn't.
Really weary, because if she could. All the way through his head, and he didn't even wait.
I'm just thinking this. This is my thought. Once the first blow happened, she put her. And it is.
Anything into this ground, you better know how to use us just rock everything.
Yeah.
It's
well,
just like this. So she must have known really good how to use a hammer and a mallet or whatever. And a peg.
This is the kind of girl you want to take camping with you. So, she could cut the wood.
She has gotten this word from him.
this?
Or did she have the opportunity to choose?
Correct.
Well, and I think she, you know, now we have that balance that we always have to deal with.
You have the same question with Eva, too. I mean, that's an assassination.
Yeah,
I mean,
definitely.
But it comes down to what does God declare of it? Because you have the same question with Abraham sacrificing Isaac. Any one of us could try to do the same thing and it would be strung up. But because God declared that it's righteous in a matter of faith, that makes all the difference.
Well, I guess from my perspective, guys, that the closest thing that I can think that would actually fit into this, for what I'm thinking right now, is actually what Jesus said to Judas. Where what did he say? He said, it is prophesied that the Son of Man be betrayed and turned over. But then he makes this statement. He says, but woe to the man who does this. So was it going to happen? Yes. Did God know Judas was going to do it? Yes. I mean, we can do all those yeses that we want to. But in the scheme of all that, Judas was still responsible for Judas' betrayal. In the same way that she is, in the same way we are. God knows what your tomorrow holds. He knows every decision you and I are going to make tomorrow. That doesn't mean our decisions are not our responsibility. They are our responsibility.
You're getting at what was her motivation for doing this. Right?
That's one of the things. I'd love to know what her motivation was. God could certainly not go to her and say, I want you to put a peg in.
But we don't know a lot of the previous history.
No, that's true.
You know, was this guy really bad to them even though
right.
they
and
made
that
this?
Possibility. We don't know.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, to the point is, if you read on into the Song of Deborah, she's praised as a hero. And to me, that's giving the stamp of approval from God on what she's done. As opposed to Judas, even though he's responsible for his actions, God didn't give a stamp.
Well, of course.
Either. But, like I said, it comes down to what does God say about
okay,
this?
But
and you don't know if God didn't come and tell her to do this just as much as you don't know exactly how he told Eva to do it the way he did it, too.
I don't think he did. I think that was human willingness, and God just used that as part of his plan. But we always have that problem is that God knows.
Right. And I don't think we'll ever be able to figure out how this works together. You know, and certainly, as you talked about in the Song of Deborah, certainly Deborah's going to be excited about what she did. You know, but if there was a song from a Canaanite person, I'm sure they wouldn't see this lady as a hero. Interesting thought. I mean, I don't think we'll ever know for sure. God certainly used it.
Yeah.
And it was a part of the turning point where God gets his people. Remember that cycle? It's one of those turning points where God gets his people back to where they need to be, at least for a period of time. So let's close out this chapter. It says, so on that day the Lord subdued Jabin, king of Canaanite, in the presence of the children of Israel. And the hand of the children of Israel grew stronger and stronger against Jabin, king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, the king of Canaan. So basically what he's saying is, he's not saying that day that Jabin was completely overthrown, but his armies were beat. Okay? And it started the downfall, and God strengthened Israel through that time. Okay?
Now, how do you think Barak felt here? You think in verse 22? Behold, as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said to him, come, and I will show you the man whom you are. See, he entered with her, and behold, Sisera was lying dead with it.
And how do you think he felt? I think he was filled with shame. And I think a mixture of shame and awe. Okay? Because two things happened. The fulfillment of the prophetess word that God would give them over, they would win the victory. But also the other thing that is this, how specific the prophecy is that he will fall at the hand of a woman. And like we talked about, I guarantee you that at the beginning of that prophecy, Barak thought that Deborah was talking about herself. And then come to find out, wow, God is very specific.
But do you really think that Now, who is it that you said that Deborah was talking about herself? Oh, that...
I think that he thought that Deborah, when it said that he will be delivered in the hand of a woman, I believe he thought Deborah was talking about herself. Because what? You're coming with me? You're going to get the glory.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that.
You know? But it didn't work out that way. Which a lot of things don't work out. That